Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Information might want to be free, but the internet doesn't necessarily have to be. Net neutrality on the program today. What Google is going to know about us, which is a lot, and the price of corn in South Dakota. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 14th of January. Good as always to have you with us. All right, so the deal is they teach you in radio school never to set up a story with a long, convoluted explanation of something. So I'm going to try real hard not to do that, if you'll bear with me here for a minute. We're going to talk net neutrality, the idea that all the data moving around on the internet ought to move at the same speed. Broadband companies can't play favorites by, say, slowing down that pipe-clogging movie from Netflix while letting other stuff move faster. And they shouldn't be able to block somebody's content just because it competes with their own. In other words, internet providers like Verizon and Comcast need to stay, here's the word, neutral. The Federal Communications Commission said so in a decision 3 years ago. All of which is a long way of setting up the story and telling you that a federal appeals court ruled today that the FCC does not have the authority to do that, enforce net neutrality. Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains what that's going to mean.
Here's the new reality. Internet service providers can now charge websites for faster access, and they can slow down content or block it altogether. Craig Aaron is the president of Free Press, a nonprofit that advocates for net neutrality. He says the ruling is bad for competition and consumers.
The phone and cable companies are now free to say, oh, well, we're going to connect you to our content, no problem. That will just put through right away. But, oh, you want to go to one of our competitors? Well, that's going to take a little bit longer, and maybe you wouldn't mind watching some ads while you wait.
Aaron says net neutrality has sparked innovation by allowing anybody to get their ideas and products to the masses. He says today's ruling threatens that by giving phone and cable companies too much power.
I think it's much more complicated than that.
Steve Weber is a professor at UC Berkeley. He says net neutrality has stifled innovation among telecom and cable companies who don't want to invest in expensive services.
For example, if you're doing telesurgery, if you're Verizon, you would like to be able to provide, say, a medical-grade network.
That won't cut out in the way Netflix movies do. With net neutrality, that's not allowed. Weber believes telecom and cable companies won't block content because consumers would flee to other providers. In fact, Verizon said today that it's committed to a, quote, open internet, and consumers won't notice a difference. But startups who can't afford the fast lane will. Scott Steinberg is an analyst with Tech Savvy.
The smaller mid-level guys are going to oftentimes find themselves at a disadvantage.
And the big guys like Google have figured out a workaround. They're starting to become internet service providers themselves. Of course, that all costs money, which we'll end up paying in one way or another. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Speaking of money on Wall Street today, up, up and away, baby. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big tech headline of the current news cycle is that Google is getting into the thermostat and smoke alarm business, $3 billion into it in point of fact. Google is buying Nest Labs. It's a company that launched back in 2011. Their flagship product being a thermostat that learns your habits and helps you save energy. You can control it with your iPhone to boot. Lots of bells and whistles on the thing. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
$3.2 billion, that's a whole lot of money. What does Google get out of this deal?
Well, Google gets into your house, phones and tablets.
All right, stop right there. That's a scary thought, man.
It's a little scary, but, you know, it's not too bad. Google does some pretty good things with giving you information immediately and sort of being smart about doing things with the information you give it, right? So Google's right now, they're doing tablets, they're doing phones. That stuff is eventually going to plateau. Those sales are going to flatten out one of these days. So Google's got one real revenue stream. I mean, that stuff doesn't even really make money. They make all their money serving ads.
Right.
And eventually that might go away too. So the company's getting serious about other opportunities. The connected home, the Internet of Things, this could be a big frontier.
All right. We'll get to that Internet of Things thing in a minute. Nest, though, gets what out of this? I mean, this is sort of the ideal startup acquisition model, right? Because they're going up against Honeywell and Johnson Controls and all these other huge, well-capitalized multinationals.
Exactly. This is what Nest gets. Nest, thus far, has been kind of the spoiler, the little guy. Nest has made a really, really nice product, but they haven't been able to scale up. Google gives them that. Google says, all right, you want global reach? We got that. You want money? We got that.
All right, so the Internet of Things. I mean, you've done some work on this on the Tech Report,
and
I know you're interested in it. This is the first step toward somebody somewhere knowing how much milk I have in my fridge and reminding me that I have to go to the store.
So picture this, Kai. Ready? You're walking out of the house. Maybe you got a kid or a pet under one arm. You've got a bag of stuff under the other arm. You're yelling at Nest, asking it to, you know, turn itself down. Turn the heat down. I'm going out of the house. And Nest says, no problem, Kai. And hey, I know you're on the way to the grocery store. You know that smutty nose IPA you Googled the other day? It's on sale. So why don't you pick some up?
Which is awesome and scary.
It is a little bit scary. Now, we should say Tony Fadell, the guy who's the CEO of Nest and now whose boss is Larry Page, says that
the CEO of Google.
Yes, the CEO of Google. So he says that basically their privacy stuff hasn't changed. They're not going to give all their data over to Google. He has promised that. The question is, will that someday change?
I read somewhere this morning, and I can't remember where it was, or I would credit the source, that this deal really and all this stuff, the Internet of Things about the connected devices in our home, is really about, I think it was the most valuable asset of our time, which is human behavior.
The way that we behave is one of the big promises of big data. I mean, think about it. Visa wants to know how you behave, right? And Visa puts a lot of money, a lot of time and effort into understanding how you behave.
And therein is the rub, right? That nexus between what Nest knows about us, our behavior inside our homes, and what Google will know about us as a result, right?
You know, I think it's a long way off. I think right now Nest is going to be focused on building stuff that is great and works really well in your house and makes your house more efficient. But, you know, eventually Google's going to want to give you an ad. Google's going to want to have you log into Google+, that sucky social network that we all love to hate. And
does this now mean we all have to be on Google+ to use Nest? I mean, that would be like apocalyptical.
That is the running joke.
Is it really? I thought of it myself.
The Twitters have been talking about it, have been tweeting about it.
Ben Johnson, he hosts Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Those who were with us last night might remember I closed the program with the observation that the Seattle Seahawks are lame. Lame, I said, for restricting online ticket sales for their NFC Championship game Sunday against the San Francisco 49ers to more or less locals, people using credit cards with addresses in the Northwest states, Alaska, and Hawaii, which is to say specifically excluding people with a California billing address. Hello, San Francisco. Excessive engineering of home field advantage was my point. That did not go over well on my Twitter feed, including this one from @SprinkleBiscuits, and I'm quoting here, "Hey, nerds, I know you all know money, but it's not rare at all for teams to limit playoff tickets to regional buyers," which, I confess, I did not know. So we assigned Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to run this one down.
So you're the San Francisco 49ers, and you have to go up to Seattle this weekend to play the Seahawks at CenturyLink Field. And aside from the damp, here's what you're up against. The Seahawks' so-called 12th man, that's the fans in the stands, are so loud they set Guinness World Records. They're so loud they cause tiny earthquakes.
Part of the reason for the ticket block to anyone outside of the Pacific Northwest is they want to make sure that they have as many loud partisans there as they can get.
Kevin Reichardt at Ballpark Digest says the stadium's built to amplify the sound and the home team advantage, adding maybe 3 points to the spread.
Among their fan base, it's great publicity. It pats all the fans on the back and say, we only want you here. We don't want anyone else here.
Of course, they can't really keep 49ers fans out. Californians have heard of scalpers. Still, this is legal? Sports lawyer Kenneth Shropshire at the Wharton School mulled this over for us.
Preferences are given to season ticket holders, for example. So the idea of giving a preference to a group, because in some way it benefits the business, as long as that group is not some sort of protected class, Asian people or black people or women.
Well, then Shropshire doesn't think it's likely to get the Seahawks sued for discrimination. And by the way, the Denver Broncos have restricted ticket sales to locals, too. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Yeah, I don't care what people say. It's still lame. Legal, but lame. All right, moving on. Coming tomorrow to your television, the 13th, if you can believe it, season of American Idol. Ratings were down last season, way down, as they were the year before. So Fox is once again promising a facelift for the singing competition. But whether you love that program or you are over it, American Idol has changed the way we watch television. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
At this point, watching some guy no one's heard of take on Stevie Wonder,
very superstitious,
and then be judged by celebs and by me can seem, well, natural.
So natural for you? I want to throw this pen at you.
American Idol gave us a new way to watch TV, by being a part of it. S. Shyam Sunder is a communications professor at Penn State.
Basically, American Idol, in my mind, introduces audience interactivity.
American Idol let us choose between Clay Aiken and Ruben Studdard, gave us some teeny tiny bit of control.
And have a say in the outcome of the proceedings on the show.
Sunder says it blends old media and new, sets the stage for more watching together while we're in our PJs, watching apart. But the show's format wasn't entirely revolutionary. American Idol also tapped into a long history of entertainment, live, amateur competition. Susan Murray is a media professor at New York University.
Even in the 50s and on radio, there had been amateur hours, popular amateur hour shows.
American Idol came up with a new formula for telling a story we've liked hearing for a long time, that our secret talents could be discovered, that the guy next door could become the next big thing. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think it'll be a great opportunity for people to experience this place and to know how many people actually gave their lives in war.
The war to end all wars, 100 years on. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 115 points today. That is 0.7%. Ended things at 16,373. The NASDAQ climbed 69 points, about 1 2/3%, settled at 4,183. The S&P 500 tacked on 19 points. That's a percent. Closed at 1,838. Turns out for retail sales, Christmas was merrier than analysts had thought. That's part of the boost today, but the holidays were not fun for everybody. GameStop unplugged 22.0% today based on its latest earnings report. Google scrolled up 2 1/3% after its deal with Nest Labs was announced. Time Warner Cable clicked up 2.7% today after rejecting a takeover bid from Charter Communications. Charter gained 2 1/3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.86%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department issues its monthly producer price index for December. The Federal Reserve releases its Beige Book Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions, the first of eight scheduled publications this year. And the first Super Bowl was played on January 15, 1967. The Green Bay Packers beat the Kansas City Chiefs in Los Angeles. Still goes good with buffalo wings and beer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Ben Johnson and I were talking about Google and its purchase of Nest up at the top of the broadcast and how, really, that's a deal about big data, companies knowing things about our behavior almost before we're aware of them ourselves. The next frontier in that? Higher education, where colleges and universities are looking for any enrollment edge they can get. Tim Lloyd from St. Louis Public Radio has our story.
Let me introduce you to Tim Murphy. I've applied to four schools, and I'm thinking of applying to a few more. The high school senior from St. Louis applied to places like Vanderbilt and the University of Missouri. And after submitting all those applications, he's not settled on his top choice.
Stories I hear from friends who go to these schools or from, you know, amount of money I'm getting from these schools, almost anything feels like it can change my mind sometimes.
As the application process moved online, kids started applying to more and more colleges. That makes it harder for colleges to predict if a student will actually accept an admissions offer. And this takes us to Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. Hundreds of prospective students and their parents are walking through the Student Center during a welcome event this fall. Director of Admissions, Todd Burrell, is the guy in a three-piece suit hanging out by the registration table.
We know there are students that are applying to more and more schools, but they only can select one.
Folks in the admissions business call this yield, or the percentage of kids who accept admissions offers. Like many schools, the university didn't hit its target enrollment last year. Fewer students means less revenue. So the school is using big data to step up its marketing game.
What can we do more to keep them engaged in this process and say, I want to go there?
The university buys contact information from testing companies and then sends all those kids emails. The moment a kid clicks a request for more information, the marketing wheels start to turn. And some institutions are taking this process to a whole new level.
As a student goes through the college search and application process, many times unbeknownst to them, the colleges are collecting information about everything that they do.
David Hawkins is with the National Association for College Admission Counseling. He says some schools are tracking emails, calls, campus visits, even social media interactions.
When the application is received, the college then has sort of a trove of data on the student.
Hawkins stresses that a student has to clear an institution's academic bar, but he says colleges don't want to offer up a spot to a student who isn't likely to enroll. So all that data is crunched in the search for something called demonstrated interest.
How likely you are to enroll in the institution if you're accepted. That's demonstrated interest in a nutshell.
Hawkins says mostly colleges want to see that the student has stayed in touch during the application process. But he says some go so far as to analyze the order a student lists schools on their federal aid application. The idea is that students will put their preferred schools at the top of the list. Under rising pressure to hit enrollment numbers, more schools are reaching out to consultants for help. And Hawkins says those contracts can be worth millions of dollars.
The profession as it exists now is almost alien to a lot of the people that got into the business 20 or 30 years ago.
Colleges are also using big data to help make sure kids leave campus with a degree, experimenting with systems designed to help catch struggling students before they fall through the cracks. In St. Louis, I'm Tim Lloyd for Marketplace.
You're probably not quite thinking spring yet, being as we are smack in the middle of January. But there are for sure some people out there who are thinking about it. Farmers contemplating spring planting, corn farmers in particular, who were told last week we've got a whole mess of corn stored up in our stockpile, so they maybe want to think about planting something else this year. We happen to know a corn farmer, met him out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota last summer on our American Futures trip that we took with Jim and Deb Fallows. Keith Alverson is his name. Keith, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk again.
Is it possible that there's too much corn going on out there?
Well, this is something that goes on year to year. When we were starting to plant the 2013 crop last spring, or plan for it, we had come off of a couple drought years across the United States, and so the surplus was pretty thin. And they had bid up the corn price and kind of gave the indication to us corn farmers that, hey, we need to have you guys go out and grow a big crop. And so a lot of the farmers, you know, we're farmers first and corn or soybean or wheat farmers second. Hmm. So we'll kind of fluctuate based on what the market's asking for.
What are you yourself going to do? I mean, you've got, I think when we were out there for American Futures with Jim Fallows, you have, what, 2,500 acres, which is a whole mess of corn. Are you going to turn it into soybeans or alfalfa? What are you going to do?
You know, most of us maintain the same balance of crop acres. There's a lot of guys that'll plant half corn, half soybeans in my neighborhood. And that really is a function of the supply-demand and just what that price ratio is between the corn and soybeans.
Oh, make me smart on that. What does that mean?
Okay, the price ratio would be just the difference between the corn and soybean price, right, essentially.
So what's more profitable for you, corn or soybean?
Right now, corn is
still
only slightly,
yeah,
whereas the last few years, corn had been significantly more profitable. You know, if there's a real close ratio where the profitability is about equal, it's easier to go 50-50. Whereas the last few years, the market had asked for more corn, and so guys came through with a big supply now.
Does it matter to you? Are you sentimental at all about corn, or is it just stuff that's coming out of the ground that you're going to take to market?
You know, I've got a soft spot in my heart for corn, no doubt about that. I enjoy growing it. It's a fun crop to grow. That being said, there's economics involved too, and we have to keep that in mind. I mean, if it was margins in the red,
you wouldn't be so passionate. Yeah. As these corn prices drop because of all the reasons we've been talking about, does it become financially tricky for you, or is it just a little market blip that you guys see all the time?
You know, it really depends on how far the prices drop.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen just since we talked last summer, about 14% of the prices went away. And
we were just out there in August.
Yeah. You know, if we think of any of our budgets across the United States, if we have a 14% decline in what's coming in, yeah, it can definitely have an impact.
Yeah, I bet. Keith Alverson, he is a sixth-generation corn farmer out in Chester, South Dakota. We met him last summer when we were out there in American Futures. Keith, thanks a bunch. We'll talk soon.
Thanks so much, Kai. Appreciate it.
Later this year, August the 1st to be precise, Belgium, France, and Britain will launch a multi-million dollar series of events to mark a grim anniversary. 100 years since the beginning of the First World War. Remembrances will go on for the next 4 years, but as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, the commemorations are a diplomatic minefield for Germany and its present-day European allies.
In some corner of a Belgian cemetery, British teacher Rebecca Bartlett reads the Great War's best-known elegy.
If I should die, think only this of me, that there is some corner of a foreign field that is forever England.
She was on the first of a commemorative series of British school visits to the battlefields of the Western Front, showing students like Tom Plowright where their great-grandfathers fought and died.
I think it'll be a great opportunity for people to experience this place and to know how many people actually gave their lives in war.
With school visits, concerts, exhibitions and other events, the British government says it wants to honour the 8 million who died on both sides of the conflict, but without pandering to what one minister called a popular left-wing misconception of the war. The notion, reinforced by the musical Oh, What a Lovely War, was that the conflict was a pointless shambles for which both sides were equally to blame. That's not how the British government sees it, nor many historians.
There is a consensus that actually Germany and Austria-Hungary are primarily responsible for the outbreak of the war.
Professor Gary Sheffield of Wolverhampton University, he says the British government is right to say that Britain and its allies were fighting a just war against German militarism.
The Germans fought a war of conquest and aggression, and the British, and indeed the French, found themselves fighting a defensive war, against an aggressive neighbour bent on achieving hegemony in Europe.
100 years on, in the Europe of today, this has an uncomfortable resonance. The German insistence on austerity measures in southern Europe has provoked anti-German protests. Anti-German feeling runs high. In a recent poll, 88% of Spaniards and 82% of Italians said that Germany now dominates the European Union. This may explain the apparent reluctance of the German authorities to commemorate the World War I centenary. Andreas Meitzner in Berlin is in charge of the German events.
We have still to decide what we will do here in Germany on this occasion.
And this in a country famous for its foresight and planning. Meitzner says Germany will take part in numerous commemorative events abroad, but he doesn't expect the country to dwell on the issue of culpability.
It's not about responsibility, who is to blame. It's about joint consequences, joint lessons we draw from First World War.
When this lousy war is over, oh, how happy I shall be.
The lesson he hopes that Europe will derive from the commemoration is the huge economic benefit of peaceful integration. But one German newspaper has written about the danger of tearing open old wounds. And like the Great War, it won't be over before Christmas. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which we are obliged once again to caution investors to double-check those ticker symbols before hitting the buy button, everybody. You remember when Twitter went public and shares of a home entertainment company with the symbol TWTRQ went bananas? Well, it happened again today with ticker symbol NEST, which is not, repeat, not the thermostat company that Google spent $3.2 billion to buy. NEST is, in fact, a penny stock, Nestor Incorporated. It is a bankrupt red light traffic camera company, in point of fact. But at one brief moment in time today, shares were up 1,900% to a high of a dime. Caveat emptor, y'all. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I am Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.